Blog Talk Radio. GoDamnMedia.com.
Everybody, how are you today? Welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Calford C. Hope you're all having a wonderful day. Mine's not going too bad. I got a knock at the door about 10 minutes before I came on the air, and it was a parcel delivery. Wow, what if he'd come 10 minutes later? Yeah, that would have been interesting. It was something I had to sign for, so it's not as though he could leave it at my door. So, boy, oh, boy, timing is everything. That is so true. Timing is everything. Actually, last night I was doing some last-minute preparations for the show for today, and I went in to make sure things were fine in the studio, and I realized that I had forgot to load something up into it. And it was just in time, to say the least, because if I had not checked at the time that I did, I wouldn't have got it in there because it would have been too late. because I come to the studio about 5 minutes before I go to air, open up the chat room, and if I had not had the clip in there, I would not have been able to share it with you later on in the program today. So, yeah, mind your time, as it were. Now, I want to talk to you about a few things today. I want to talk to you about, well, I have a top 10 list here. And actually, that's something I could have loaded up. David Letterman's top 10 music? No, doesn't matter. I have top 10 reasons here why Islam is not a religion of peace, and I'll tell you why. I'm going to start with number 10, okay? And I'm going to tell you why I'm doing this. Because ever since 9/11, we know Muslim leaders, they, each and every one of them who has access to the national media or international media, they're trying to tell us that Islam is the religion of peace and that violence does not represent the essence of Muhammad's religion. Now, our politicians have been snowballed into this. We know President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair, they repeated the assertion. They're the ones who are saying that Islam has been hijacked by a few violent fanatics. Well, you know, I feel kind of bad for the Muslims, yeah, because 98% have made the other 2% look really bad, don't you think? You know what I'm talking about. Personally, yeah, 98% of Muslims are fanatics. Actually, I'll go for that stat, although Kel's making a funny, not a very funny, but a funny all the same. It's not empirical, though. It's not empirical that Islam is not a violent religion, but it is empirical that it is. We have observable facts that Islam does demonstrate that it is capable of violence. It is filled with violence, not only in the life of Muhammad himself, but in the Quran as well. So these Muslim apologists, they got to stop misleading these unsuspecting Westerners. They have to stop that. They must be honest about the heart of their religion, and they have to be honest about it once and for all. I have clear 10 verifiable reasons that explain why Islam is not the religion of peace. Let's start with number 10, and we'll work our way down. Muhammad nicknamed his weapons. Now, this is according to Taberi. He is an early Muslim historian. He's quite reliable, in fact, because the State University of New York Press, they selected his history to be translated into 38 volumes. So this guy clearly knew his stuff. Like I say, he was born in 839 and he died in 923. So he's a few centuries after Muhammad, all the same. Pretty early recordings, pretty early observations made. So he's considered to be a very reliable historian. Now Muhammad, yeah, Taberi, he said Muhammad nicknamed his weapons. He nicknamed three swords that he took from the Jewish tribe. Oh, pardon me. Quenuka, after he banished them from Medina, and that occurred in April of 624. That's right, when he chased all the Quenukas out of there. One of his swords was named Pluck Out. The other, Very Sharp. And the third, Death. He had two other swords from elsewhere he nicknamed Sharp. And that is Want Who Sink, and presumably that means into the human flesh. Now, after his hijra, or immigration, from Mecca to Medina in 622, he owned two swords called Sharp and having the vertebrae of the back. Now, this last sword he collected as booty after his victory at the Battle of Badr in March of 624. So he nicknamed his weapons. All right, fine, very well, very good. And might I add, they're not very creative nicknames. What's the name of your sword?
Oh, this is Sharp.
Oh, okay, thanks. Not very bright either, right? Yeah. Now, apparently, he also took three bows from the Quenuka tribe, and he named them as follows. Most conducive to ease or wide, white and of nab wood. Now, nab wood is a species of tree which bows are made from, right? So he named one of his bows of Nabwood. Gee, nice bow. What's its name? I name it of Nabwood. It's made from the tree, you know, Nab. Like, I'm telling you, not very creative. Of course, we found out the hard way throughout history that, yes, actually, he was more creative than we ever wanted him to be. Now, Muhammad himself, he had a nickname. He had a few nicknames, but the one that's not so positive and so not so complimentary is the Obliterator. Muhammad, one of his nicknames, the Obliterator. Now, these Muslim apologists, they're going to object that Tabari, he's not an authoritative on the Quran nor the life of Muhammad. However, they are quick to praise him when he shows Muhammad is heroic or victorious. But they'll say that, no, he's not authoritative, and he's not on the same level as the Quran and some of the hadiths, and we know the hadiths are the words and deeds of Muhammad outside of the Quran. Now, this may be true, but Muslim apologists still must answer why such a tradition of naming weapons developed around Muhammad. You know, after all, later unauthoritative traditions about Christ developed, but they do not show him even owning weapons, let alone naming them. And that is absolutely correct. Jesus Christ, despite some misinterpretations about the life of the Son of God, there may be a few who do not quite get the life of Christ correct all the time, but nowhere do you find anybody asserting that Christ owned weapons, and he certainly did not name weapons. Thus, violence sits at the heart of early Islam in the life of Muhammad. Therefore, Islam is not the religion of peace. Now we move down to number 9. Muhammad commands in his Quran that adulterers and adulteresses should receive 100 lashes. This is from 24-2. Strike the adulteress and adulterer 100 times. Do not let compassion for them keep you from carrying out God's law. If you believe in God and the last day, and ensure that a group of believers witness the punishment. Now, the supposed historical context of the seerah occurs during a raid of a tribe in December of 627 or January 628. They're not quite sure about the exact month, on which Muhammad brought his favorite and youngest wife, Aisha, to the daughter of Abu Bakr. Actually, Aisha is the daughter of Abu Bakr, yes. Muhammad's favorite wife, we all know her as Aisha, she is also the daughter of Abu Bakr. And Abu Bakr was Muhammad's right-hand lieutenant, one of them. Now, after the Muslims' victory, they journeyed back to Medina, and that was 150 miles to the north. Now, on their last halt, Aisha answered the call of nature. However, she lost her necklace in the dark. And this was just as the army was setting out from their encampment early in the morning. Now, she had left her litter, of course, to answer the call of nature. And she went back. Okay, everybody was packing up. It's getting time to leave. But she decided to return back to where she had answered the call to nature to look for the necklace. Now, she found it. But what happened is that the caravan had left. They assumed that she was in her curtain litter, and they led the animal away, carrying her litter. They carried on. Now, Aisha, she returned, and she found that she had been left behind. Now, there was a handsome young man, a Muslim man. His name was Safwan. He saw her and accompanied her back to Medina. Though both the Muslims and Muhammad's opposition wagged at their tongues at seeing the two youngsters entering the city together, that it didn't look too good. But it was, you know, there was a revelation later on that came to light that Aisha was not guilty of any immorality. She had merely wandered off to look for her necklace, and so all was very well and good. And the young Muslim man, Safwan, was merely just leading her back, getting her out of the forest, as it were. Maybe forest? Would it be forest? Would they have had forest there? I don't know. Either way, she was stranded. She needed a hand. A dude came along and helped her. Okay. Good guy. But Sira 24, it establishes some ground rules against adultery, of which flogging 100 times is one of the rules. Now, I don't know whether it was this incident in particular that brought this on. I don't know what Muhammad was thinking, but all the same, this little Sira came along and voila, here we go. We've got strike the adulteress and adulterer 100 times rule. New rules. Muhammad was famous for that, as we know. He made up things as he went along. He changed things all the time. You know the Quran is abrogated. Holy smokes, big times. The thing doesn't even make sense. It's not even in chronological order, for goodness sake. But yeah, he came out with this hadith. And he said yes. Now, I don't think it wasn't immediate. But there was another example here I wanted to share with you, and I'm just looking for it. Apparently, there was a woman. And she came to Muhammad, and she was asking for purification. What that means is that she wanted to be punished for her sins. Muhammad told her to go away and seek God's forgiveness, but she persisted 4 times and admitted that she was pregnant as a result of fornication. So he told her to wait until she had given birth. Then he said that the Muslim community should wait until she had weaned her child. When the day arrived for the child to take solid food, Muhammad handed the child over to the community and ordered the woman's death by stoning. So whether or not immorality, suspected immorality on Aisha's part, and the confessions of this adulteress triggered Muhammad that there had better be a little bit more circumspect behavior within the Muslim community. Now, there was one person in particular, Khaled B. Al Walid. He was one of the stoners, and he came forward with a stone which he threw at her head, and when the blood spurted over his face, he cursed her. He swore at her, "You got blood on me, fill in the blank." So apparently Muhammad told Khaled to be gentler. So we're kind of wondering, what do you mean? How much gentler can he be? Maybe throw the rock at only 30 miles per hour as opposed to 40? But perhaps Muhammad was ordering Khaled not to curse her. But in any case, the Prophet prayed over her dead body and then buried her. Truthfully, how effective was the prayer when Muhammad and his community murdered her in cold blood? They should have forgiven her and let her go to raise her child. Even some Muslim apologists today do not accept these hadiths, then they still have to answer why the true God would send down the harsh punishment of lashing in the Quran, and that is Sira 24-2, when the New Testament says nothing about this. Now, Christians should therefore rightly reject this verse, for Christ forgave the woman caught in adultery and told her to go and sin no more, and that is from John 8:1-11. He showed us the better way and taught the will of the true God. Thus, cruel violence sits at the heart of early Islam, in Muhammad's life and in his Quran. Islam, therefore, is not the religion of peace. Muhammad, in his Quran, permits husbands to beat their wives. This is from 434. Husbands should take full care of their wives, with the bounties God has given to some more than others, and with what they spend out of their own money. Righteous wives are devout and guard what God would have them guard in their husband's absence. If you fear high-handedness from your wives, remind them of the teachings of God, then ignore them when you go to bed, then hit them. If they obey you, you have no right to act against them. God is most high and great. Hope you're paying attention to what I just read there. If you fear high-handedness from your wives, okay, High-handedness. What exactly is high-handedness? Chastising your husband? What is the punishment for telling your husband that maybe you spent a little too much money on that? Is that high-handedness? Because Muhammad thinks it is. Now, this was written in the historical context of the Battle of Uhud, which took place in March of 625. Islam lost 70 holy warriors. This verse belongs to a larger collection of verses that outlines laws for the family, such as how to divide the inheritance, and how to oversee the assets of orphans. But plainly said, Surah 434, it specifies that husbands may beat their unruly wives if the husbands fear high-handedness. Now, that's quite apart from whether the wives are actually being high-handed. So this puts the interpretation of the wife's behavior squarely in the husband's judgment, and this swings the door open to abuse. This verse embodies a gigantic cultural and social step backwards and should be rejected by all fair-minded and reasonable people. There was an incident here where a woman, she was the wife of Rifa. She came to Aisha one day, and she was wearing a green veil, and she complained to Aisha of her husband and showed her a green spot on her skin caused by beating. Now, it was the habit of ladies to support each other. So when Allah's apostle came, Aisha said, I have not seen any woman suffering as much as the believing woman. Look, her skin is greener than her clothes. In which case, Muhammad struck Aisha. He, Muhammad, struck me on the chest, which caused me pain. So what was Aisha doing? Was she was engaging in high-handedness. Look, you got to stop this. Back to your corner, woman. Thus, the hadith from the Sirah 434. Thus, domestic violence sits at the heart of early Islam in the life of Muhammad and his Quran. Islam, therefore, is not a religion of peace. Now we move on to number 7. Number 7. Muhammad in his Quran commands that the hands of male or female thieves be cut off. This is from 538. Cut off the hands of thieves, whether they are male or female, as punishment for what they have done, a deterrent from God. God is almighty and wise. But if anyone repents after his wrongdoing and makes amends, God will accept his repentance. God is most forgiving and merciful. That's probably the part of the hadith that they'll quote to you, by the way. Now, three passages in the hadith, they interpret Muhammad's policy and provided its context. This is just a quick compilation taken from Bukhari and Muslims. Now, Aisha, as we know, was the favorite wife of Muhammad, reported the Prophet saying, a thief's hand should be cut off for only a quarter of a dinar and upwards. And dinar, D-I-N-A-R, that's monetary. A thief's hand should be cut off for only a quarter of a dinar and upwards. So they don't have to be thieving very much. I mean, like, a dinar is not a small sum, but it's not a huge one either. But one-fourth of a dinar merits the loss of a hand. Wow. Ibn Umar said the Prophet had a thief's hand cut off for a shield worth 3 dirhams, and that is another monetary. Now, the shield, it was fairly expensive, and supplies were kind of tight, and they couldn't afford to be losing their battle weapons. But one shield is equal to one hand, really. You can get your hand cut off for stealing eggs or stealing rope. Now, we know in a lot of cases these punishments are not carried out, but we also know in some rather exceptional cases they still are today. This is the Sharia. These practices are still carried out. Saudi Arabia, they love their Sharia law. I don't know. But it is very, very draconian punishment within the Quran and under Sharia law. Punishment is very draconian. You can stone your adulterer to death. A wife is buried chest high, a man up to his waist, and they are stoned to death. If you're caught thieving, be prepared to have your limb taken off. And, of course, what they usually lop off is your right hand, because according to Sharia law and the Quran, the left hand is for cleansing yourself, the right hand is for eating. The right hand never touches the nether regions. That is for the left hand to do the cleansing. So not only are they losing their right hand, they're also being humiliated because now they only have one hand which must engage in both tasks, that of cleansing and that of eating. Harsh and excessive punitive violence sits at the heart of early Islam, in Muhammad's life and in the Quran. Islam is therefore not the religion of peace. We are moving down to number 6. Muhammad assassinates poets and poetesses. These two poets represent others in early Islam. Yuqba bin Abu Mayyat. Yuqba mocked Muhammad in Mecca, and he wrote derogatory verses about him. He was captured during the Battle of Badr, and Muhammad ordered him to be executed. "But who will look after my children, O Muhammad?" Yuqba cried with anguish. "Hell," retorted the prophet very coldly. Then the sword of one of his followers cut through Yuqba's neck. We have somebody else here. Ashma bint Marwan. Ashma was a poetress who belonged to a tribe of Medinian pagans and whose husband was named Yazid bin Zayed. Now, she composed a poem blaming the Medinan pagans for obeying the stranger, and that would be Muhammad, and for not taking the initiative to attack him by surprise. Now, when the false prophet heard what she had said, he asked, "Who will rid me of Marwan's daughter?" A member of her husband's tribe volunteered and crept into her house that night. She had 5 children, and the youngest was sleeping at her breast. The assassin gently removed the child, drew his sword, and plunged it into her, killing her in her sleep. The following morning, the assassin defied anyone to take revenge. No one took him up on his challenge, not even her husband. In fact, Islam became powerful among his tribe. Previously, some members who had kept their conversion secret now became Muslims openly because they saw the power of Islam. So conjectures an early Muslim source that reports the assassination. Yeah, I'm sure they became very openly and devout after that little incident involving the poetess Asma. Gee. I'm just going down here. There's a lot of sirahs and hadiths in here. I'm not too sure if I really want to bore you with all of these details. But needless to say, there are too many accounts in the Quran for the Islamic apologists to deny that there is violence within their so-called religion. It's in the Faris 3, 186, 33, 57, 33, 59, 61, 961, 63. Look it up. They're all there. And believe me, you will not be accused of misinterpreting these passages because they are right there. However, though, even if Muslims reject the early non-Quranic sources where these assassinations are found, they still must answer these questions. Why would such a tradition grow up around Muhammad in friendly Islamic sources? That's right. These scholars were friendly to Muhammad. What is it about Muhammad that produced such reports? Why are these friendly sources eager to present the prophet in a positive way, despite what he is capable of decreeing? Thus, bullying and murderous violence sits at the heart of early Islam, in Muhammad's life and in the Quran. Islam is therefore not the religion of peace. Now we're halfway through the list. I'm telling you, I could think of 14 million more reasons why Islam is not a religion of peace. And I just want to welcome Poppy. Hi, Poppy. Thanks for joining me, sweetie. It's great to see you. Now, number five, Muhammad in his Quran commands death or the cutting off of hands and feet for fighting and corrupting the land. Here we go again. Chopping off the limbs. This is from 535. Indeed, the punishments of those who fight Allah and his messenger and who do go around corrupting the land is to be killed, crucified, have their hands and feet cut off on opposite sides, or be banished from the land. That is a disgrace for them in this life, and in the life to come, theirs will be a terrible punishment. Except for those who repent before you overpower them. Know them then that Allah is all-forgiving, merciful. Oh, yeah, yeah. But you know what? Get them. Funny. Get them first. Yeah. Now, according to the Hadith, the historical context of these verses runs as follows and clarifies fighting and corrupting the land. Some Arab tribesmen visited the Prophet but fell sick in the uncongenial. I thought there was a T in there, and I thought, is this a typo? So I'm trying to read this word, and it's like, no, it's uncongenial. But anyway, yes, this Arab tribesman, he was visiting the prophet, and he fell sick because the climate of Medina was uncongenial. So he recommended an old folk belief, drinking the milk and urine of a camel. Subsequently, they are reported to have felt better. However, for some reason, after departing from Medina, they killed some of Muhammad's shepherds and turned apostate and drove off the prophet's camels. The news reached Muhammad, and he ordered them to be hunted down and brought before him. He decreed that their hands and feet should be cut off, their eyes gouged out, and their bodies thrown upon stony ground until they died. Maybe if you hadn't have told them to drink camel piss, they wouldn't have done anything, Muhammad. This is the prophet, the so-called prophet in Islam. I don't know if drinking the milk and urine of a camel really does have medicinal benefits. Who on earth knows? But we know that Muhammad wasn't quite all there anyway. But once again, this gruesome violence, it sits at the heart of early Islam, in Muhammad's life and in the Quran. Islam is therefore not the religion of peace. Now we're moving down to number four, and this involves Muhammad aggressively attacking the Mecca caravans. Now, a year or so after Muhammad's hijra from Mecca to Medina in 622, he attacks Meccans. He attacks their caravans six times. And he sent out a punitive expedition 3 days away against an Arab tribe that stole some Medinian grazing camels or cattle, totaling seven raids. The chief point to notice is that the Muslims took the offensive. with one exception. The seven expeditions were directed against Meccan caravans. The geographical situation lent itself to this. Caravans from Mecca to Syria had to pass between Medina and the coast. Even if they kept as close to the Red Sea as possible, they had to pass within about 80 miles of Medina. And while at this distance from the enemy base would be twice as far as their own base. That's right. So in order for the caravans to travel, they had to get pretty close to Medina, and they were vulnerable to caravan raids in which Muhammad was an active participant. Muhammad was indeed a caravan raider, and he was a robber. Why was his hand not cut off? It's got to be emphatically stated that the Meccans never sent a force up to the doorstep of Medina at this time. They did later. They did later on when they got fed up with Muhammad's aggressions. It is true that the Meccans gathered forces to protect their caravans, but when Muhammad confronted them, they were many days' journeys away from Medina. Like I say, they're far away from their home base. Two Muslim apologists are misleading when they assert that the caravans passed through Medina, adding that the Muslims haphazardly sought to whatever spoils they could get, whereas the Meccans mobilized for war. No, that's not what happened. They went out of their way to look for these Meccans and to rob them. Meccans weren't wandering into hostile territory, nor were they spoiling for a fight. They were acting reactively because they were sick and tired of Muhammad and his gang coming down on their caravans all the time. So, aggressive military violence. It sits at the heart of early Islam. In Muhammad's life and in the Quran, Islam is therefore not a religion of peace. Now we move to number three. Muhammad in his Quran promises sensuous gardens for martyrs dying in a military holy war. One we are familiar with, because we're seeing the Shaheeds running around all over the place, aren't we? Yes. Throughout the Quran, Muhammad promises the men in his fledgling Muslim community that if they die fighting for Allah and for him, Allah will reward them with a virgin-rich garden. You can find this in the Sirahs 44-51-56-52-17-29-55-46-78. Lots about that in the Quran. So happy reading, folks. In the following Quranic passages representing others, these would be the Sirahs 4-74, 9-111, 3-14-143, the Arabic word jihad is the means or currency to trade in this life for the life to come in an economic bargain. 61-10. You who believe, shall I show you a bargain that will save you from painful punishment? Have faith in God and His Messenger and struggle for His cause with your possessions and with your persons. That is better for you, if only you knew. He will forgive your sins, admit you into gardens graced with flowing streams, into pleasant dwellings in the gardens of eternity. That is the supreme triumph. And the thing is, they still buy that to this day. This is the 21st century. There are young men and women out there who believe that if you kill in the name of Allah, you will reach paradise, and your 72 black-eyed beauty virgins will be waiting for you. I'm telling you that I can almost see them believing that, but only because their earthly life is so miserable. Living underneath the thumb of Islam, how could your life be anything but? Especially for these young men, some of them growing up. under such harsh conditions. And I do not mean in poverty or that sense, because that sort of thing is relevant to how you are used to living in the first place. They may get a little jealous of what they see, the excesses of the West, but as far as I'm concerned, with the exception of the Miley Cyruses on the planet, the West is pretty decent. We just know how to take care of ourselves better, and we have we know how to run an economy. Over there, they don't. But all the same, life must be so miserable. They must crave to have something to believe in, and I swear some of them probably plead to become a Shaheed or a suicide bomber or a suicide killer, because they just want to get the hell out of their earthly misery and get to those 72 virgins so bad. But these verses are found in the historical context of the Battle of Uhud, and that is from 625. Muhammad lost 70 of his fighters. Thus, he must make the loss of life appear worth the sacrifice. So he frames their death in an economic bargain. Note the word in bold print, okay? Bargain. Note that word in your mind as bold print. Bargain. If his jihadists trade in or sell their lives down here, they will be granted Islamic heaven. It is a done deal. Thus, deadly, heavenly violence sits at the heart of early Islam in Muhammad's life and in the Quran. Islam is therefore not the religion of peace. We are moving down to number 2. Muhammad unjustly executes around 600 male Jews and enslaves the women and the children. This is after the Battle of the Trench in March of 627. It's named after a trench that the Muslims dug around parts of Medina against large coalitions of Meccans and their allies. Muhammad imposed the ultimate penalty on the men in the Jewish clan, Koriza. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. Koriza. It's Q-U-R-A-Y-Z or Z-A-H. This is his third and final Jewish rivals that he's battling. He banished the Kenuba tribe in April of 624, so now he's going after the Koriza tribe here in 627. He annihilated the Nadir tribe in August of 625. So let's see. He has eliminated the Kenuba tribe in 624. He eliminated the Nadir tribe in 625. Now he's going to annihilate the Koriza tribe, which has taken place in March of 627, also known as the Battle of the Trench. The Koriza tribe, they were supposed to remain neutral in the battle, but they seem to have intrigued with the Meccans and to have been on the verge of attacking Muhammad from the rear. They were judged guilty by one of their Medinian Muslim allies, though Muhammad could have shown mercy by exiling them, as they actually requested, or at least just executed only a few. But no, he went ahead with this sentence: death by decapitation for around 600. Some people say it was closer to 900. Muhammad also demanded that the women and the children be enslaved. He also decided that he was going to take a beautiful Jewish as his own prize. Muhammad was wise enough to have 6 clans execute 2 Jews each in order to stop any blood feuds. The rest of the executions were probably carried out by his fellow immigrants from Mecca, and it lasted the whole night. That was the Battle of the Trench in March of 627. Now, you note this atrocity? It has been enshrined in the eternal world of Allah. And the Quran seems to celebrate it. But those questions must be answered. Is it intriguing with the enemy equal slaughtering 600 men and enslaving women and children? And who decides? Any reasonable and fair-minded person would judge that Muhammad was not making his response via execution proportionate to the breach of the agreement. The Khoriza tribe never attacked the Muslims, and even if a few were to have done so, the punishment does not fit the crime. Therefore, Muhammad was being excessive and disproportionate because he used an irreversible penalty to express his human wrath. Thus, anti-Semitic violence sits at the heart of early Islam, in Muhammad's life and in his Quran. Islam is therefore not the religion of peace. And now we move down to the number one reason why Islam is not so nice. That is Muhammad and his launching of his own crusades. In the following verse I'm going to recite to you, Muhammad uses the Arabic word qital, which means warring, fighting, or killing. This is from 9-29. Fight or qital. Those among the people of the book, Christians, who do not believe in Allah and the last day, do not forbid what Allah and his messenger has forbidden and do not profess the true religion till they pay the poll tax out of hand and submissively. Now, the two most intriguing clauses in this violent verse are, one, people of the book, Christians in this verse late in Muslims' life, are to be attacked if they do not profess the true religion, that being Islam. Now, this leaves the door wide open for terrorists today to attack and fight Christians because they do not adhere to Islam, right? And number two, Christians must pay a tax for the privilege of living under the protection of Islam. They must do it submissively or in humiliation, and we know that is the jizya tax, right? Now, the historical context of Surah 929 finds Muhammad preparing for a military expedition against the Byzantine Empire in 630, 2 years before his ordinary death of a fever in 632. Indeed, some scholars regard Surah 9 as the last surah to be revealed from on high. Therefore, it sets many policies for Muslims today and is often interpreted as abrogating or canceling previous verses, even the peaceful ones. Pardon me. Muhammad heard a rumor that the Byzantines, they amassed an army some 700 miles to the north in Tabuk, that is northern Arabia today, in order to attack Islam. So he led an army of 30,000 holy warriors to counterstrike preemptively. However, the Byzantines, they failed to materialize, so Muhammad's belief in the false rumor was misguided and his expedition was fruitless, except he managed to extract, or rather extort, agreements from northern Christian Arab tribes that they would not attack him and his community. An army of 30,000 soldiers from the south must have deeply impressed the northern tribes, so they posed no real threat to Islam. They are the ones who had to pay the protection tax mentioned in Surah 929. So do the tribes and cities. They still had to do it after Muhammad's death. Therefore, Muhammad's forced tax was aggressive and hence unjust, not defensive and hence just. Muhammad's military expedition, it qualifies. It qualifies as an Islamic crusade long before the European ones. After all, guys, in 638, only 6 years after Muhammad's death, Muslims' armies conquer Jerusalem. Today, Muslims should never again complain about European crusades unless they first come to grips with their own. Exactly. Thus, crusading violence sits at the heart of early Islam, in Muhammad's life and in his Quran, and beyond, even reaching to today's Western world. Islam is therefore not the religion of peace. Now, I got the link here. What I might do, I don't know. Maybe what I'll do is I'll put it in my blog later on for you who are not in the chat room and are listening in archive. and you can't get to the chat room, maybe I'll put it in my blog at redfoxblogger.blogspot.com. There is a lot more to this article, but it's very, very dense there. So, yeah, I think I want to share it with you in my blog, maybe. Now, okay, I've got something going on here with my my screen, so it keeps telling me that create a new tab, that it keeps taking me out of my studio. And I just lost my studio, so, okay, hold on a minute, folks. Dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, I've gone everywhere, man. I'm just going to open up a new window and do a little backtracking here. While I'm doing that, I will entertain you with my singing. Da, 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 da. No, I'm just kidding. I will not do that to you. And I got my studio back. But, oh boy, I'm going to take a bit of a break, just a short little musical break. It'll give everybody a chance to refresh their teas and do whatever it is they are doing. I was on my Facebook page there, and my friend Jeremy posted this song for me, and I thought it was pretty darned nifty. He sent me a message with it saying, "This is right up your alley, Cal," and I love this song. I just love it. I want to share it with you. It's called "What Does the Fox Say," and it's by Elvis. Elvis with a Y, not an E. So, Jeremy, thank you. This is for you.
Dog goes woof, cat goes meow, bird goes tweet, and mouse goes squeak. Cow goes moo, frog goes crow, and the elephant goes toot. Ducks say quack, and fish go blub, and the seal goes ow, ow, ow. But there's one sound that no one knows. What does the fox say? Big blue eyes, pointy nose, chasing mice and digging holes. Tiny paws up the hill, suddenly you're standing still. Your fur is red, so beautiful, like an angel in disguise. But if you meet a friendly horse, will you communicate by more? How will you speak to that? What does the fox say? What does the fox say? The secret of the fox, ancient mystery, somewhere deep in the woods, I know you're hiding.
And welcome back, everybody. Just to remind you, you're listening to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Cal Fritzy. Now, I hope you glossed a little bit about the top 10 reasons why Islam is not so nice, right? I'm telling you, one thing we can certainly figure out is that Islam, they love fighting. And if they can't fight with their neighbors, they'll fight with their families. And if they can't fight with their families, they'll stand in front of a mirror and they'll fight themselves. Islam is that. Islam is all that. It is a violent, violent political ideology. See, I don't consider Islam a religion because it is mixed up in politics. Sharia law is the law of the land. That is politics. Nowhere do you see Christianity engaged in politics. As a Christian, I can worship, but I obey the laws of man. As a Muslim, I can worship, but I must obey the laws as set out by Muhammad. That who is considered a prophet, which would make him above man. We do not do that in the West. This is why we have to disallow any foothold of Sharia or any form of jihad to work its way here to a point where the camel has gotten its nose into the tent so far we cannot push it back out. I'm reading my newspaper, okay? Oh, you know, just having my morning tea or whatever, opening up the dailies, perusing the headlines, and I came across this. Firefighters douse a car fire. Now, this has nothing to do with Islam, but I want to make a point with this. Okay, so this is in a Toronto Daily. Toronto fire officials say that car fires are more common than people think, and the latest example happened Sunday morning. Firefighters were called around 8:45 a.m. to deal with a 2002 Mercedes SUV, which was engulfed in flames. Crew members on a pumper truck from Harbourfront Station doused the fire. No one was injured. Concerns that the fire might flare up again prompted firefighters to follow the burned SUV as it was towed to the wrecking yard. And that's the story. Okay? That's the end of, that's it. That was in that made news, right? Okay. What? What's the next headline going to be? Mailman delivers mail. Plumber fixes sink. There is so much trial and tribulation going on out there, and this is what they're reporting. Firefighters douse car fire. Oh, and they got a picture of it. Yep, here we have a car. It's on fire. Oh, heaven. Please. Please. And then, you know, you go to another story and you read about an 8-year-old girl who died of injuries on her wedding night in Yemen. Yes. An 8-year-old bride. Kuwaitis, they've called for stringent action against a family in Yemen after their 8-year-old daughter died of internal injuries on the first night of her arranged marriage to a man more than 5 times her age. Rawin died in the city of Hart in the government. Okay, this is in a. This is obviously not written. English is obviously not the first language in which this was written, so the grammar is really messed up. She was 8 years old, guys. This is from the Gulf News, by the way, from today, September 9th, 2013. She is believed to have suffered a tear to her genitals and severe bleeding. Now, Yemeni activists, they urged the local police to arrest the beastly groom and the girl's family and transfer them to a court where justice could be served and the case would be used to help put an end to the practice of marrying very young girls in that impoverished country. So the Yemeni activists, yeah, they want the local police not only to arrest the groom, but they want the entire family on the girl's side arrested as well for even entertaining this proposition. Islam. That is Islam, people. This is the 21st century. They're still engaging in all of these barbaric practices. They're still engaging in honor killings. They're still engaging in child marriages. They're still engaging in violent kinetic jihad. Now, as we know, there's a lot going on out there in the world. Poppy just sent me a link in my email. I'm going to investigate that more thoroughly. But it looks like things are developing. Things are very much developing over this business in Syria. I think I was at Reactionary Show the other night, and somebody put something, a link in the chat room, so I noted that this, it was a safe source, so I opened up the link, and I'm glad I did. This is a YouTube video. I don't know if you have heard this already. I have it here for you, though. This is very interesting. There is... here we go. John McCain was at some sort of round table, and it was open mic. And so a gentleman got up, and he called for John McCain to be arrested and to be tried for treason. I'm going to let you take a listen to it.
Hi, Mr. McCain. I mean this with all due respect, sir, as an elected official for our country. We the people elected you to be representative of the people and against this great, or, and for this great nation. But for far too long now, and the rest of Congress, including the executive branch of government, along with the judicial and legislative, have turned your back on the American people and their core values and principles. I can say with great confidence and speak on behalf of all Americans that your actions against this country are treasonous. All of you, against the will of the American people, have aided and abetted the enemy. You and the rest of Congress, including the President of the United States, have went against the will of your people in Syria, regardless of your position and vote, whether it is a yes or no, is still a political smokescreen. I believe wholeheartedly you do not care about the will and well-being of the America or its people. You lied to the American people about the chemical attacks in Syria. The American people know that it was our government that is most likely responsible. There is strong evidence, including video, that these attacks were carried out by Al-Qaeda, and you advocate starting a war, even maybe world war, by taking the same attack and blaming it on Assad. President Barack Hussein Obama has been supporting terrorism. The United States has been funding and aiding organizations, including the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda, for many years now. The same enemy we're supposed to be defeating on the battlefield. At least one country in this world stood against this government terrorism that you guys support in Egypt, the people of Egypt throughout Mohamed Morsi, which Obama supported as well, as countless Christians have lost their lives under evil people such as this. You swore an oath to protect us and protect from all enemies, both foreign and domestic. The simple irony is, the domestic enemy now in this country is the people and government of the United States. And McCain and you and the rest of our leaders are accountable for their actions. It's too bad someone like me is not in office to hold you accountable, because if I was in a position of power or authority, I would have you all arrested and tried for treason against my country under the grounds of 18 U.S.C. 2381 Treason U.S. Code. Whoever owing allegiance to the United States levies war against them or adheres to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort within the United States or elsewhere, is guilty of treason. That is the code. The American people are sick of it. This country rose up against you recently. I have a right of free speech. I can finish. The American people opposed to going to war with Syria, which includes many Marines and other veterans by the thousands, was 499-1. That is 99% of the people of this country. So if you and the rest of this government are truly for the American people and representatives of us, I suggest this time you listen, because nobody wants another war or strike in Syria or anywhere else. Bring our brothers and sisters home. I am truly disgusted that you people are my leaders.
Well, sir, I look forward to you running for office. Nobody's preventing you from that, even in this treasonous country. Register. I don't know if you're registered to vote or not, and run for office, and we'll be glad to put you to the up for the voters and have their opinion. I put myself up the voters now 8 times.
So what do you think of that, hmm? Yeah, I found that very, very interesting, too. What can I tell you? I had something else here, and I'm just looking for it. I'm not sure where I put it, but... Nope. Oh, wait a minute. I found it. Sorry, guys. I'm getting a little thrown off because... I was trying to read something that was sent to me, and unfortunately, I can't report on it because I really haven't read it. But I'm being told that it's news all over the place. But I'm sorry, I work until 5 in the morning, and I don't get up until like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So if it's all over the news, probably haven't gotten to it yet. But do you remember there was a case where a Walmart employee was fired because he put a picture of 3 Muslimas in the faux niqab on his Facebook page? Yeah. What did he say? He said, why do they come here dressed like that? Get that F off and get the F out of my store. Take that shit off and get the F out of my store. Oops, sorry, the S word just kind of popped out on me. So he was fired. Okay, Walmart, you dimmies. I'm not going to your store anymore, Walmart. They fired him because he took a picture of them. He put it up on his Facebook page, and he was denigrating them. All right. So Walmart, they took action. They fired him. Now, what is really going on with this? I have a funny feeling the Muslim Brotherhood Front Group CARE, the Council on Anti-American Islamic Relations, they threatened litigation, jihad, to get Walmart to fire the employer. It was his damned Facebook page, his own time, his own post. Now, I find that in itself bad enough. However, this Walmart employee apologized. He apologized to the Muslims. I got a very short clip here. I want to share this with you because you have to hear it to believe it. I was just flabbergasted when he said this.
Good evening, everyone. It's the shocking post on Facebook that has people talking across the country.
Tonight, the former Walmart manager who took aim at Muslims is talking to News 4 and apologizing for hurtful comments that cost him his job. At the center of all this is this picture showing 3 Muslim women shopping inside the Walmart in Hamburg.
News 4's Ed Dranch has the story you're seeing only on 4 tonight. Ed?
John and Jackie, these women that you see right here behind me were doing something that Terry Ersing would have done with his children, shopping for school supplies at Walmart. Suddenly, though, these customers became victims, targeted because of their faith.
These Muslim women became the butt of a joke on Terry Ersing's Facebook page. He posted, quote, "Halloween came early this year. Do they really have to dress like that? You're in my country. Get that blank off."
I've embarrassed my friends, my family, and myself.
The picture was taken inside this Walmart on Southwestern Boulevard in Hamburg, where Ersing was the assistant manager. He was fired shortly after this was posted.
I apologize to everybody, including the Muslim community. I hurt people that I didn't know.
Ersing says his friend took the picture.
It started out as a joke on Facebook. I meant it as a joke. Anybody that knows me and knows my character knows that I try to post funny things or sort of things that are like, a little bit of black humor, but it backfired.
A Walmart spokesperson would not comment on the company's social media policy because it's a personnel issue. She did say, however, the company has high expectations for its associates, and Ersing failed to meet those expectations.
They like the popularity piece of being able to get feedback from everybody, and they're not recognizing the long-term ramifications.
Mental health counselor Lynn Schein says questionable content should be kept off social media.
Even if it's just for a time or you think it's a funny joke or you want some feedback from other people and friends, you don't recognize it. Once you press send, it's for the world to see.
In a digital age, this digital image and its caption will now forever be linked with Terry Earsing.
Do you think it's likely you're going to get another job after this?
Doesn't look too good, does it?
The New York chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations called on Walmart to discipline Earsing. That resulted in his eventual firing, which is something he says was justified. Reporting live tonight, Edge Ranch, News 4 at 11.
Yeah, so I looked for this guy on Facebook, and yeah, he's still there. He's on Facebook. I sent him a private message, and I said, hey, look, you know, I'm really sorry that you're going through all of this, and I'm really sorry that you became another victim of the care witch hunt. But he never replied to me. But I am running. I'm going to close it up a little, a few minutes early, because I thought I was going to spend more time on the 10 reasons why Islam is not good for us. I went through that a little faster than I anticipated. And I don't want to delve into another topic because if I do, I will run over the clock. So I kind of mistimed myself. However, I do want to share with you that you have to start listening to some of these radio programs here on Blog Talk Radio and elsewhere, and become apprised of what Islam is, because I can sit here and talk to you until the cows come home. We all can. But you have to listen. We give you the tools to do your own research, to carry on. We encourage you to do so. People have to understand the very threat of Islam. Islam is a threat to the West. Islam is not a race. Islam is not a religion. Islam is a problem. Go out there, educate yourselves, because if you don't, your children will look at you one day and say, why didn't you do something? And what will you do then? And do not be dissuaded by the dhimmis. Do not be dissuaded by the Islamic apologists. Do not be dissuaded by being called a racist or a bigot or even worse. These are words they use only because they cannot come up with a decent rebuttal to your inquiries, to your argument, to your logic, to your knowledge, because you are listening to some of the finest programs here on Blog Talk Radio. As a matter of fact, I have Vito Esposito in my chat room. He is one of the radio hosts on the Radio Jihad Network. Vito Esposito, in fact, he has his show Monday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, so you listen to Vito tonight at 6 p.m. He'll tell you. On the Radio Jihad Network, listen to them on Tuesdays. You got Andrew Bisoy on Tuesdays, 11 p.m. Eastern Time. He'll tell you. Listen to Eliza Jane at MP91 Freedom Quest, Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. She'll tell you. Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Listen to Gadi Edelman. He'll tell you. On Friday, listen to Dr. Mark Christian and Corey Miller at 11 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll tell you. On Saturday, listen to Usama Dakdok at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. He'll tell you. And on Sunday, listen to the Uncle Dave Show at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, because he'll tell you too. I'm noticing a trend in radio, not only on Blog Talk Radio, not only on Internet radio, but on terrestrial radio as well. I am noticing a bit of a trend, and that the topic of Islam seems to be making its way into a lot of the formats of these shows. Whether or not that is due to the age of the Internet and that Islam knows that it cannot hide, we are becoming exposed to the atrocities more and more every single day. I don't sit here and spout nonsense, ladies and gentlemen. I know what's going on out there. I do my research. I do my homework. I'm not a scholar by any means. Gosh, no. I leave that up to the likes of Gadi Edelman and Usama Dakdok, for goodness sake. Andrew Bisoy, those guys. They're the scholars on Blog Talk Radio on their Radio Jihad Network. I'm here as a citizen journalist, as a layperson, sharing with you my observations, what I see, my very subjective opinion. And, of course, you do know my opinion of Islam. I do not like it. In fact, I despise it. I despise things when I come across stories like a Shia Bibi, a Christian in Pakistan, sentenced to death for supposedly blaspheming their so-called unholy prophet. You may remember her. She was that Christian lady in Pakistan a couple of years back who dipped her cup in a bucket of water in the fields as they worked. And the Muslimas around her complained and said, well, we can't touch that water now because it's been... Well, apparently they won't drink the same water that an infidel dipped her cup into. So she apparently said, your prophet died with worms in his mouth, which means that he was not a prophet. And, well, this is apparently she said this, okay? So what do? They run off and they tell the local cleric and they arrest her and they sentence her to death. She is a wife with two children. Now, I was actually talking, well, not talking, I was just on Facebook, and I noticed Jamie Glassov was on there, so I asked him if he knew of any follow-up, and I haven't heard back from him. Like I say, I had to get back to work, and then I had to get some sleep. But I want to investigate that one a little further, too. Ladies and gentlemen, a few programming notes as well from the Red Fox blogger. There will be two additional shows this week. As you know, I tape my show Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time and Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. But I'm having a 9/11 special as part of a 9/11 tribute marathon, and my time slot is Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. So I will be back on the air on Wednesday. And on Thursday, Randy L. Noble returns. Randy L. Noble, he does a segment on the Red Fox blogger once a month. So he will be back this Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, and that will be The Cross in the Desert. So please look forward to listening to Randy L. Noble on Thursday. Please listen to my 9/11 special on Wednesday, and also be back at my regular time on Friday at 7 p.m. And just to remind you, my guest will be Pamela Geller. I hope that you tune in and listen to that. I hope it will be a fantastic show. I hope all the shows that I'm bringing your way are fantastic. I hope you're enjoying it. I hope I'm not putting you to sleep. Okay, guys, that is it. And look at that. Wow, I nailed it right down to the letter. See, I never shut up. It's amazing what happens when you ask me a question and I just start talking. You know what? The thing is, you don't even have to ask me a question. I'll talk anyway. This is what I do best. I never shut up. I love it. And I want you, too, to have a voice and voice your concerns and voice your criticisms and voice your opposition against Islam and Sharia law. Believe me, your children will thank you. I'm not only a big mouth, but I'm that infidel. I'm the infidel fox in the Muslim hen house, and they know it. On that note, I want to wish you guys a great afternoon. Like I say, I will see you back here Wednesday for a 9/11 tribute special at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.